S-I-B-O-O, San Francisco, by my baby!
Shiba Shiba! Shiba Shiba! Shiba Shiba!
Let me in!
Shiba Shiba!
I wanna be closer to you!
Shiba Shiba!
Open up your soul!
Shiba Shiba!
Let me find that part of you! The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your love.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or when it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. It is Scintillating Science Monday, this beautiful Labor Day, and we are going to talk about artificial intelligence. Here to talk about it, I'd like to welcome Lee Diana. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on. So before we get started talking about your specialty, when were you first bitten by the love of science?
I think I remember when I was a kid, I really loved going to the science museum. Mm-hmm. I grew up in London and there was like an awesome science museum there. So I remember that. I also remember I really liked watching ants, mm-hmm. actually in the playground, like seeing how they organize themselves and were able to just somehow know where to go magically. I think I was like, I don't know, from as long as I can remember, basically.
So were you one of those
curiosity?
Were you one of those kids that asked like a million questions that nobody could answer?
Yeah, I was always asking questions. I feel like all kids are like that. But maybe I was especially annoying.
But what ignited your desire to actually study the sciences?
I think that I really like the idea of being able to, like, figure something out that no one had figured out before, like, solve some mystery and uncover some secret of the universe. Like, mm-hmm. it sounded very like epic to me to be able to do that. So maybe from like the sci-fi books I was reading that had like mad scientist characters or mm-hmm, something, mm-hmm. it sounded really fun and like cool. Yeah.
So did you relate to the mad scientist or the people trying to thwart the mad scientist?
I think that like I wanted to be like, I wanted to be as brilliant as the mad scientist, but, like, not evil.
Got it.
Like, so
you'd have been on the side of the thwarters who are just a little bit more smart.
Yeah, something like that. I kind of forgetting the specific stories. I remember there are just so many different books that I love to read, and they're all kind of blurring together now. But, it just sounded like, I think I was always obsessed with, like, magic also and mm-hmm. superpowers. Mm-hmm. Like, I loved, like, X-Men and Teen Titans and stuff like that, and Harry Potter, like, and I just thought, well, science is maybe one way that we can kind of get closer to having superpowers and magic and stuff like that. Maybe that was another thing that excited me as a kid.
So then when you went into the sciences, did you first start with artificial intelligence, or did you go a different route and end up there?
Yeah, so initially I was actually more excited about synthetic biology. That is like bioengineering, sort mm-hmm. of create like engineering cells, bacteria, E. coli, for instance, mm-hmm. to do something useful for you, like create biofuel mm-hmm. Or detect cancerous cells. I was at first more excited about that because it felt like there are just so many new developments mm-hmm. in biology, like happening really fast mm-hmm. in like this century, basically. I remember hearing that like last century was the century of physics and this century is going to be the century of biology. The idea of being able to like, because I loved animals, I loved nature, like being able to kind of tinker with that sounded really cool. Mm-hmm. So that was what I was first interested in.
And then how did you end up studying artificial intelligence?
Yeah, so I actually tried doing synthetic biology once I got to college. Mm-hmm. I joined my school's iGEM team. iGEM stands for International Genetically Engineered Machines.
Okay.
And that is like a synthetic biology competition for undergrads, and you get to sort of learn everything. And so I was so excited. Like, I was one of the first people to like apply to join the team because mm-hmm. I'd been like reading about it for so long. Mm-hmm. But then I actually really didn't enjoy kind of the day-to-day work of like pipetting things and measuring things. Okay. Like, it felt very repetitive and tedious, kind okay. of doing a lot of those like tasks over and over again, and you have to wait so long for the cells to grow, and then they were contaminated, and then you have to start again, mm-hmm. and you have to go in at like awful hours of the night because that just happens to be when you take a measurement. So that kind of put me off doing like biology lab work. And so then I was like, okay, but I'm still interested in like I guess complex living systems and living things. And I guess one of the most interesting questions about living things is like intelligence. How do they think? Like, how do they actually organize their behavior? Like, what are moods, memory, skills, learning, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so then I actually initially went to like, I interned at like a C. elegans lab, which studies this like totally transparent worm called C. elegans that you can then like look at all of its neurons.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, okay, I'll study intelligence in these worms because like human brains are really hard to look inside, but this worm you can look at. But then I think that I then felt like this worm couldn't do as much as like a human could, obviously, uh-huh. in terms of the types of interesting behavior that it could exhibit.
Uh-huh.
But then obviously it is hard to look inside a human brain. So that's how I then finally got to AI, which is like, okay, you recreate like a totally simulated brain, and then you can totally look inside it as much as you like because it's all just on your computer. And maybe through building that, you can understand it in some way. Yeah.
Now, since we don't really know everything about the human brain, how reliable is the brain that you're building in your machine, or how closely, like what percentage can it emulate the human brain?
Yeah, it's very not close to a human brain in many ways.
Okay.
And so like what my aim has then been really to, like I have this, I believe that there are elements of intelligence that are not like unique to the human brain, but mm-hmm. could be common to like common principles that all forms of intelligence must follow. Like, for instance, there's a lot of like information theoretic principles that just hold universally, like throughout the universe. It's not possible to get information from some data that just isn't there in the first place, for instance. So I was kind of thinking I can try and look for these more universal principles that would exist both in a human brain and in an alien brain and in a computer brain. If you are able to understand those principles, you could try and like verify it by recreating it. And it might be different at the implementation level. Like, it's not biological neurons, but like there's lots of interesting behavior that happens at a higher level that doesn't really, like, it doesn't really matter as much what's going on at the hardware level. You can still create similar emergent behavior at the higher level. I think I see a similar thing with like convergent evolution, where totally different like sort of branches of the evolutionary tree end up sort of, you get animals that have developed like very similar traits because they just happen to be like really good solutions mm-hmm. to survival in different kind of niches in the environment. Like, one thing I would think about is how a lot of different sea creatures end up kind of looking like crabs, even though they're not actually related to crabs, because that happens to be a really like efficient solution to thriving in the ocean. I think it's called like calcification or something like that. So yeah, I think that kind of gives me hope that there are some things that can still be understood, even if you don't have a close replica of a human brain, or not even close, like very far replica. But you have sufficient sort of computational power and complexity in there.
So I've got a whole bunch of questions just from that answer. First of all, what are some of the universal principles that people, you can say with confidence exist? And then I also would like you, well, we'll start with that one. What are some of the universal principles?
Yeah, I guess I gave that quick example of, you know, if you're trying to learn something from some data, you can't like learn information that wasn't in that data in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of information theory, I think, is a good guide to intelligence, because it's about like how you're able to get things, get like inputs from the world around you and process them and use that to do something useful. Another one I'd say is something that I've been studying recently is sort of intrinsic motivation. I think that it's important for intelligent beings to be able to like have some internal motivator that can allow them to explore, even if they're not immediately getting rewarded or they're not immediately finding food. They need some way to drive them to look around and sort of take sort of very like long distance exploratory behavior,
mm-hmm.
In such a way that will actually let them finally reach some goal or some food that they didn't even know where it was in the first place. And so I've been studying like what are some kind of motivating functions that could be guiding humans that could also guide other forms of intelligence or AI. And there's all sorts of like interesting proposals for intrinsic motivation, such as one form is the idea of like the most simple one is the idea of entropy, where you want to be exposed to a distribution of inputs that are as entropic as possible.
What's entropic?
So entropy is like the kind of the spread of different things you're seeing being like a very even spread.
Mm-hmm.
So like a totally fair dice is more entropic than a very biased dice where it always lands on one, for instance.
Okay.
So it's much more likely to land on one or two than any of the others.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of one of the most simple ideas or principles, is that you would get bored if you're seeing a lot of one kind of input, like you're seeing a lot of trees, you'd get bored of that and you'd want to have a more entropic distribution of inputs. That would A more entropic one would be like you see some trees and some rivers and some mountains,
mm-hmm.
and some lakes. That would be a more entropic distribution. So that is an example of like a simple sort of information theory inspired idea about what might be helping motivate intelligent beings to explore even before they know where the food is or where the rewards are.
Okay, well, that takes me down a different road, which is,
mm-hmm.
I'm writing down my question so I can keep. So when you talk about this distribution, and then when you think about how artificial intelligence is sort of fed to humans, which is there's an algorithm that keeps feeding us the same stuff, how do you teach artificial intelligence about that entropy and the need for that variety?
Oh, are you talking about like recommendation systems?
Well, just like let's say you go to YouTube and it's like or any new thing and it figures you out, and then it's like, this person likes this, I'm just going to keep feeding them this because they'll keep coming back. How do you make an artificial intelligence that understands that humans will get bored with that and that it should be more variety?
And this is something that actually someone in my group, who I think also was a science envoy and came on your show, is an expert in. If you remember Micah Carroll, he works on recommender systems, like stuff like the algorithm that recommends videos on YouTube. And like studies how they might end up like showing people very narrow and increasingly polarizing content, because
yes,
sometimes that does just get more clicks.
Mm-hmm.
I think this question is very like, I think there's so much to this question that is kind of like not really what I study so much. This is very like practical and applied, like how should you be designing these systems for the good of society, and also, like, these companies need to turn a profit, but, like, how do you balance all of that? Like, I feel like that's kind of not really within my expertise, I'd have
okay.
to say.
Then I know that you are interested in how AI systems continually learn.
Yeah.
And you talk about intrinsic motivation. How do you build intrinsic motivation into an AI system?
Right, so I specifically work on reinforcement learning AI agents.
And what's
so
that?
So reinforcement learning, yeah. Reinforcement learning is this idea of you have an agent that can actually take actions and then make observations from the world around it. And then the actions it takes will have it transition into new states. And it's totally driven by getting rewards from the environment. So with each action it takes, it gets an observation and it also gets some reward. And so reinforcement learning is this idea that, like, it's kind of inspired very much by animals, where you can train a dog to do tricks by mm-hmm. giving it treats whenever it does something that you want it to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, humans also maybe had to evolve to figure out how to get food and how to build shelter, and there are rewards that sort of evolutionarily programmed in that sort of guide us towards survival. And so, yeah, it was originally biologically inspired, I believe. But now there's this question, can we use this concept to create artificial intelligent agents? And so the field of reinforcement learning and AI basically builds these models that also observe the environment and choose an action and try to learn based on the rewards how to act in the future to maximize these rewards. So that's kind of the basics of reinforcement learning. And so I think a simple takeaway from that is with reinforcement learning, a key question is how do you even design the rewards
yes.
to get your reinforcement learning agent to do the thing that you want it to do? There are dangers where if your reward is too difficult to find, like maybe you're trying to get it to navigate a maze and then the reward is at the very end of the maze, but it's a huge maze and your agent starts really far away and there's many twists and turns and dead ends, it might never find that. Mm-hmm. And so that's where intrinsic motivation can come in useful. So a lot of people who build RL agents will be trying to think how they can add bonus rewards to help guide the agent towards the goal and make it less difficult for them to actually discover the goal. And these bonus rewards are often thought of as some kind of intrinsic motivation, and they can be like biologically inspired or inspired by information theory. So what you would do is you'd basically take that reward function that maybe initially would only give you a reward when you actually reach the very end of the maze,
mm-hmm.
and you can add extra rewards into other parts of the maze. And then you still run your regular reinforcement learning algorithm. So the reinforcement learning algorithm is what looks at all the rewards that have been obtained, as well as all of the actions that were taken and all of the different observations that were made about where you were, for instance, and then like synthesize all of that into seeing all of this, I think this is the best way to act. That's called a policy. A policy is like a policy that like a country might follow or mm-hmm. that a company might follow. It's this is how I'm going to act given this situation. So a reinforcement learning algorithm takes all of the observations, actions, and rewards, turns that into a policy. And then intrinsic motivation is basically saying, we'll add extra rewards so that now when you take all the extra rewards plus the existing rewards and everything else, it's easier to find the best policy. Because you've now provided a lot of like clues about what is a good direction to go in. So that's how intrinsic motivation is usually added. It's added for reinforcement learning agents by basically adding on extra rewards so that there are more places where you get rewarded than originally, which then provides you more learning signal.
So when I heard all that, it sort of reminded me of like watching people play video games, is that,
yeah.
you know, you can keep the agent in this case is the person playing the game. You can keep them doing this really hard task by dropping rewards throughout.
Yeah, very much so.
But what about when the agent is actually the machine itself? What are the rewards for the machine?
Yeah, so the machine can also, like, read these rewards. I guess in this video game example, the way I think about it with humans is, say you're playing Mario, and there are, like, coins scattered throughout the level. And so you can kind of be encouraged to move forward by, like, going to pick up the coins. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, like, you might say it's obvious that you need to move forward anyway, but there are also cases where there's, like, secret hidden zones that you wouldn't be able to find usually, but actually there's, like, a little, like, path, like, a little string of coins that then gives you a clue, like, oh, if I go and grab these coins, maybe there's something at the end, and it will actually... Following those coins leads you to some secret hidden chamber that has even more coins in it. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's how I see, like, the analogy of, like, when humans are playing video games, the video game designer adds in these little rewards along the way to help give clues about where you're supposed to go. Otherwise, it would also be frustrating and mm-hmm. too difficult for humans to enjoy and play that game. And just similar to humans, the machine is able to, like, perceive that it's been collecting rewards. That becomes part of its observation. So as I was saying, the machine basically takes all of the observations, actions, and rewards that it's collected, and then, like, does some processing on that and uses that to determine its policy, how it should act in the future. Some examples of what it could do is, maybe it's actually building its own, like, model of the world, mm-hmm. such as, like, model of the world. It could even be, like, you know, Maxwell's equations, like, Newton's laws. Like, it's building some model that can predict, like, how the physics of this particular game world works. If I like, press this button, this makes me jump 3 feet in the air. And if I press this sequence of buttons, then I'm more likely to get rewards than if I press that sequence of buttons. So that is what the machine is doing. It's like looking at this data it's collected, which is all of the experiences that it's seen, all the rewards, actions, and observations, and then turns that into, like, uses that to determine what it should do next to get more rewards in the future. So that's how, like, you're adding in these rewards, the machine then sees them and then takes that into account when deciding what to do next, because that becomes part of its model of the world.
So does that mean that there is someone who is programming the system to perceive these things as rewards, or is the system developing its own interpretation of what the reward is?
So these systems are basically programmed to be able to, like the person who designs the machine, who programs the machine, determines what should be done with the rewards and how the machine should use these rewards to decide what to do next. And so it's all basically inside the algorithm that has been written by the designer of the machine. The algorithm tells you how to go from the whole data set, which includes rewards and observations and actions, and turn that into a policy. And that's, like, there's many different algorithms that people have come up with to do that. So mm-hmm. some of them involve, like, trying to learn, like, a physics model and a reward model of the world. And then you can then use that model to do planning and then decide or run lots of simulations inside that model. And then you can figure out, oh, if I did this inside my simulated world, this good thing will happen. So I'll do this. There's other different algorithms that people have come up with that don't try and build a model of the world, because you can argue, oh, that model is always going to be inaccurate because the world is far too complex to really model well, especially when you've only seen a few, a small amount of experience of this world. So maybe just forget trying to build a model. Instead, let's just directly try and figure out what actions will give you more rewards and totally circumvent the modeling aspect. Let's just throw a big deep neural network at it and get a deep neural network to predict these actions will lead, which actions will give you the highest rewards. Or maybe let's try and learn, there's this other thing called a value function, mm-hmm. which basically is a estimate of how much reward you'll get in the future given your current state and the action that you take next. And so you can try and learn this value function that can then, if you learn a good value function, then that can actually tell you, okay, now I'm at this state, I'll take whichever action maximizes my value function. So there's many different ways people have come up with of, like, taking all of the experiences that the machine has collected mm-hmm. and getting that to convert into a policy for the machine to follow. But yes, that is all programmed in by the designer of the machine.
So I have heard about that there are artificial systems that develop their own internal algorithms that people don't even know what's going on in the algorithm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so in reinforcement learning, there is also this thing called meta reinforcement learning, which means learning to learn, basically. The meta, like up one level.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, I mean, there's also related areas such as neural architecture search. Basically, people have tried to automate this process of designing this algorithm by hand, by trying to instead, I mean, also there's a lot of decisions you're making in terms of if your algorithm uses a neural network, how big is that neural network? How deep is it? How wide is it? What types of layers are inside? And so people have definitely been working on trying to automate this and see if you can do better than what like a human designer could come up with. I think probably a lot of these algorithms you're referring to where the machine learns an algorithm that humans don't understand is actually in large language models, where people have found that large language models have maybe been able to learn algorithms for solving certain types of problems, where all you see is that you gave it like a prompt that was asking it to solve the problem, and then it gives you the answer, like it just tells you the answer, but there was some processing happening inside this massive language model, and it can be very hard to know if it actually understood the question or whether it was just kind of pattern matching or like it had seen that question before somewhere in its training data, and so then it was able to retrieve it. Because it's such a huge model, it can be very difficult to see what's inside. And there is like a burgeoning field of like interpretability for these large language models. Like there's actually several different approaches. Like mechanistic interpretability is one approach, which is about trying to discover circuits, I think, inside these models. There's other approaches where you're looking at which neurons in these models are getting activated and trying to see what kinds of inputs activate which neurons, or maybe you can see which inputs give you similar activation patterns to what was getting activated when it was solving your problem. It's still a very like developing field, and I think there hasn't been consensus yet as to what is the best way to interpret these models. But in some cases, I have seen some very impressive mechanistic interpretability papers that were able to actually like point to like specific algorithms that they were able to find evidence for that seemed kind of pretty convincing. They're able to show that when a large language model was solving some sort of like arithmetic problem, it was actually doing some kind of Fourier transformation and doing something on the bases. And it's actually not at all how a human would solve that problem, but these large language models have access to pretty different kind of machinery and tools that humans do in terms of what sort of like memory they actually have that they're able to work with. Again, this isn't my expertise, but sure. I think a lot of the discussion about what is going on in these models, they're learning algorithms we don't even understand, is actually about these large language models. And people have been trying to take the findings from large language models on basically about pre-training on massive data and applying that to reinforcement learning. But that's still an ongoing process and it hasn't gotten as like big yet.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's touching your mind right now? Well, it's Scintillating Science Monday, and therefore I have a scintillating scientist. Science envoy Li Dayan is from representing WonderFest, and we're talking about artificial intelligence. I want to actually talk about what is your specific area of expertise and what is your research? How would you characterize your research for people who don't know anything about artificial intelligence?
Okay, for people who don't know anything, I would say that my research is on artificial agents that can make decisions and take actions inside a world, and how to get them to learn and explore, even in sort of very challenging environments. You can think of like difficult video games, for instance, mm-hmm. where there's lots of enemies and you can only get points if you get to the very end of a level. So that's kind of what I work on in very simple terms.
Okay. Okay. So, and then I'm reading the little blurb about you, and understanding reward shaping through a Bayesian perspective. What is that?
Okay. So reward shaping is this idea that I was sort of talking about earlier, where you add extra rewards mm-hmm. into this environment mm-hmm. to make it easier for your artificial agent to figure out what to do. Just like when you play a video game, you might be able to get points along the way before you finally beat the big boss. You beat the like little boss, or you just collect some coins and that leads you to like the next location in the map. Like there's in these video games, the video game designer realizes that humans find it hard to just figure everything out from the beginning mm-hmm. and they'll give you these clues. Similarly, AI agents can use these clues too. And so like this isn't new in terms of the field of AI. People have been using these reward shaping functions for a long time, but I've been working on trying to better understand when they work and when they don't work using a Bayesian perspective. So first I'll talk about when they might not work. A very famous example is the noisy TV problem. Mm-hmm. So this is when there is a maze that has a TV screen that is just playing like totally random, like flipping channels randomly. And so one idea people had of a form of reward shaping that will encourage your AI agent to explore is this idea of, oh, you want to actually see a lot of different things that you can't predict. Mm-hmm. Like whenever you see something new that you wouldn't have expected, you get a little reward. Mm-hmm. And that can encourage you to explore more widely instead of just getting stuck in a corner and like, oh, I'm not getting any reward. Everything's pointless. I'm going to mm-hmm. stay in this corner forever. And so, I mean, it also kind of matches human intuitions where if you as a person were playing a game and you're just seeing the same like blank wall over and over again, you'd get bored and you'd want to go look at something new. And so a proposal was to have a reward bonus based off of a like a model that predicts what happens next. And then if it gets the prediction wrong, then you get a reward bonus. And that gets you to explore further, to go to like new unpredictable areas of the maze. But then you add this TV screen that is just showing you random TV channels. Then if you just use this simple prediction error-based reward shaping, you have an agent that just sits and watches TV for the rest of eternity, because it's always going to show you an unpredictable new channel.
Okay.
And so we'll never be able to get bored of this and stay there forever. So that's an example where reward shaping can go really wrong. And I've been trying to understand, like, what should reward shaping really be, like, in a principled way? What is it really telling you about the environment? Or how do you go from knowledge about the environment to then an idea about how you should design reward shaping? And so this Bayesian perspective is basically that. So Bayes' rule is this rule that helps you go from, you have a prior over the world, what kind of world you're in. It could be like a prior over, is it going to rain today? Mm-hmm. It could be over any question that you might have. Mm-hmm. And then you observe some new evidence, and then you update your prior based on that new evidence to a posterior. So that is Bayes' rule.
Okay.
And so, yeah, sort of like a simple like rule of probability. And so the Bayesian approach to reward shaping that I've been thinking about is basically this idea that reward shaping is actually kind of reflecting something about what kind of world you might be in.
Mm-hmm.
And so really what a RL agent is doing when it's exploring, it needs to explore because it doesn't already know the world it's in. If it already knew the whole world it was in, then it wouldn't need to explore. It could go directly to the reward, go straight to the goal. And so I think that's why exploration when you think about exploration, I think it's helpful to think about it in Bayesian terms. Basically, when you get dropped into this new world, you don't know what world you're in yet, mm-hmm. but you have a prior over what kind of world you could be in, just like you could have a prior over, like, if it's going to rain today or not. And then you go around and you, as you collect more data from that world, you can then update your prior and get a better and better idea about what world you're in and where the rewards might be. Just like when you start, like, seeing the sky getting cloudy, you could update using Bayes rule to realize that your probability of raining gets higher and higher. So that's kind of the idea of, like, exploration with this Bayesian approach. You have a prior over where the goal is, what sort of world you're in, and then you're updating it. And so the reward shaping is basically a way of injecting sort of extra information about what world you're in to help the agent. And if you think about it that way, then that actually, I think, clarifies a lot of cases in which the reward shaping breaks down. Like, for instance, in that noisy TV example, that kind of reward shaping is basically telling you that, like, in the world that you're in, you're in a world in which, like, observing an unpredictable input is valuable. You're in a world like that.
Okay.
And so, like, maybe you could have been, if you were in a different distribution of worlds where that was true, then actually it would have been appropriate to keep watching the noisy TV. Because in that prior of worlds, you actually would have a chance of just getting to the goal by watching the TV. So in reality, that reward shaping, it's not like it's totally broken. It's just that it's designed for a different distribution of worlds than the one you're actually in, and that's why it doesn't work. So, like, I think when I gave the example initially, it just kind of seems obvious, oh, watching TV isn't going to get you anywhere. You need to, like, get up and start walking around. But really, it could have been a world in which, like, if you watch the TV long enough, suddenly, like, the winning numbers for the lottery would flash on the screen, and then you would be winning. And so really the reward shaping has to reflect what kind of world you're in. And if you know you're in a distribution of worlds in which that would never happen and the TV never has anything useful and all of the rewards are somewhere else, then that reward shaping is broken. So yeah, if you think about what distribution of world you're in, what is your prior over what kind of world you're in and where the reward might be, that can give you clues about what sort of reward shaping is really appropriate for helping you explore in the right way and not get stuck where you're never going to get any rewards.
Okay. So in your, when you're doing your research, like I really get what's going on when you're applying it to gaming, but how do you, what other ways can you use the knowledge that you're gaining outside of the gaming world?
Yeah, so I think I'm really just curious about, like, understanding intelligence generally. And so this isn't super applied. Like, my motivations aren't super applied.
Okay.
Like, you could apply it to gaming, to designing fun video games that aren't too difficult. But and it's, like, a colorful example to sort of introduce the work.
Yes.
But I'm really more curious just about, like, in general, what kinds of functions, what kinds of things about the world can be inherently motivating. And that's sort of just a curiosity about intelligence, about, like, human cognition, about reinforcement learning. I could think of other sort of uses of this, actually, though, because I do think it is important to, like, while I'm doing this research, also think about ways that it could eventually go out into the world and help people beyond just furthering basic scientific understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I think another cool use of this is actually for education. It's really important for, learning to play a video game. You could also think of applying this to learning how to use a new piece of software, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever tried to learn how to use Photoshop, for instance, it's so complicated. There's so many different menus and buttons and pop-ups and tabs, and it's really frustrating. And so you could apply it to that. But also in more, like, basic education, if you can understand what motivates people, then it can be much easier to design curriculums, design educational tools and exercises that will be more interesting for people and keep them engaged, versus just kind of telling people things sort of at, and expecting them to just memorize it all. So I think that's another sort of interesting and very helpful use case. But yeah, I just think it's like sort of also at a philosophical level, it's very interesting. What is, what motivates people? What is the, how do people find meaning? What makes something interesting? What piques curiosity? I think that's just a generally interesting question by itself.
It is, it is. And with that, what do you do when your data set, when what the machine is being fed is inherently flawed or biased? How do you offset that?
Yeah, so with reinforcement learning, it's actually interesting because this is a case where generally the data is completely collected by the agent itself. You're not giving it a data set that you collected and telling it to learn from that. Like, it starts with zero data. Mm-hmm. It's just been dropped into, it's like a baby dropped into a new world, and it has to choose what actions to take, just like a baby chooses which direction to crawl and which toy to, like, grab and put in its mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And that way it's collecting all of its own data and experiences. And so that is, like, bias there is also a problem. There are some cases where your algorithm might be too optimistic or too pessimistic. And so, to explain that with the baby example, maybe the baby, like, picks up one toy and that toy, like, has some chocolate in it, or it, like, plays a really nice tune. And then if the baby was too pessimistic, it might think, oh, this is, like, the best toy I'm ever going to find, so I'll just keep playing with this toy forever and never going to try and play any other toys.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you have an issue because the data it collected so far is very tiny. It's just seen one toy. And then it doesn't have, like, a full representation of all the toys out there. And then it might just stay stuck playing with that same toy forever. So that is also an issue for designing reinforcement learning algorithms. But I'm not sure if this is the bias you're talking about. Are you talking more about bias, like, that is faced by models that are trying to, like, classify humans and, like, make decisions about giving loans or stuff like that?
Yes. Like realizing, like, for example, they did things where a machine would offer suggestions of who to bring in for a second job interview. And by analyzing the data of the company, the machine learns that, oh, well, it doesn't, there's not a whole lot of women, so I guess we shouldn't recommend women. There's not a whole lot of people of color, we shouldn't recommend people of color. It's learning from the data, which is already biased. So how do you prevent an artificially intelligent entity from furthering or reinforcing the bias in a way that can't even be quantified because people don't know what's going on inside of it?
Yeah, I think it's really hard. Like, honestly, I'm not sure it's, like, a good idea to be using AI that so far has not been well understood to make these kinds of important decisions. I mean, at the same time, like, humans are also biased and have seen biased data where humans are full of, like, internalized biases and stereotypes. And again, we can't, like, dissect someone's brain and be able to point to why they made a specific decision. They might not know their own biases themselves. And even if they did know, they probably wouldn't want to admit it.
But
going to pretend that humans are perfect. AI, I feel like, is like currently kind of people have shown that it has done some stuff that is even worse than what humans would do in terms of the decisions that it might recommend. I think that just it's probably good to just have a better understanding of it before trying to use it to make those kinds of possibly very biased decisions. I think people have made efforts to create, like, interpretable versions. Like, you can sort of take a huge and difficult to understand AI model and try to distill it down into like a smaller and more interpretable version, mm-hmm. And then just use that distilled version. And then you might be able to understand better how it's making its decisions and whether it's biased or not. But then people say, oh, those ones tend to be less accurate. And so then, you know, but then probably better to trade some accuracy for like a fairer model, right? Mm-hmm. So that is one approach. Another approach, I think people are, it's maybe a growing field, maybe not. I think it's kind of had its ups and downs in terms of popularity, but this idea of causality, trying to incorporate causality into these models, sort of understanding, getting them to understand the difference between causation and correlation. Mm-hmm. So like, oh, there is definitely a historical correlation between being a white man and being successful. But then you could maybe have a model that understands that that's like it's not due to an inherent property of being a white man that mm-hmm. makes you better. And so, yeah, there's techniques for that that involve like counterfactual training, like when you generate sort of different examples in your data set that sort of basically demonstrate to the model that like if this hadn't happened, then this would still happen. Mm-hmm. Therefore, this isn't causing that. And so that is, I think, like a growing area of research. Is again, not my expertise, but I believe that's something that people are looking into, and having sort of incorporating causality might be one way to improve these models' fairness and like decrease the bias, maybe.
Okay. So when you are doing your research, what is something that you came across that just sort of blew your mind?
That blew my mind.
Where you were just like it was difficult, either difficult to wrap your brain around, or it was something that you just thought was so elegant that you just, you know, you were in awe of it.
That's a good question. I'm trying to think of one that will be like easy to explain.
Well, I'm not intelligent, but some of my listeners are, so go with the one you want to go with.
Okay, let me think.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. I've got my science envoy on the ropes. They've got lots of things that they're trying to tell us, but maybe we're not smart enough to know what the explanation is.
No, I didn't say that. I guess one thing that I thought was like really quite cool was a result from a project that I was working on last year. And I wasn't the first author of this project. I was more like playing like a helping out role on this. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to like claim that this is my brainchild, but I was really like kind of, it was really cool to see that this just worked by itself. Mm-hmm. So this project was about like how can you get a machine to discover the concept of objects. That sounds very like what does that even mean? Uh-huh. But so usually when people have been training these machines to recognize objects, you give it a lot of data where someone has actually like labeled, this is a tree, this is a cat, you know, whenever mm-hmm. you have to fill out a CAPTCHA, it will be like, click all of the images that have a bus in it. You know, everyone's mm-hmm. had to do that.
Yeah.
So a lot of AI is trained on those kind of things that really is telling it this is what an object is. But this project was, can it discover what an object is just by itself? And so I think this field is sort of called unsupervised learning, mm-hmm. where you aren't telling it everything and you can see what can emerge by itself. Mm-hmm. And so in this project, the data consisted of like little animations of objects moving around. Mm-hmm. And so you just had like images of like a table with different kinds of objects that could be like a bowl or a cup or a plate or a spoon. And then in the animation, the different objects are moving to different places. Mm-hmm. And that's it. There's no like labels. There's no boundary boxes, nothing. Mm-hmm. And then you're training this model to be able to predict what the next frame of the animation is going to be if you tell it what action was taken. So you have the animation, you also have an action, which is in the form of, like, pick something up at position, like, 3, 4. That tells you, like on a chessboard, like, the grid coordinates of where you pick something up.
Okay.
And then move by this distance in this direction, and then put down.
Okay.
So, yeah, so then we're training a model to, like, look at these animations, predict, given the action and the current sort of frame of the animation, what the next frame is going to look like. And purely based on this goal, it was able to actually understand the concept of objects. And I thought that was just really mind-blowing. And I think it says something, like, kind of deep about the nature of, like, yeah, information and compression and, like, structure inside data, where, like, really the easiest way to solve that problem is to discover that objects are a thing that exist, and that the, like, different objects move independently of each other. Like, if you move one object, the other objects are going to stay in the same place. And so that is just the, like, the natural solution to being able to understand the world around you is to discover the idea of objects. And I think this kind of ties into my sort of general sort of belief in that, like, trying to study AI as a way of understanding these sort of universal concepts of intelligence. Like, humans, we have a notion of objects, but that also wasn't because some alien came down and pointed out different objects to us and defined them to us. But because we noticed that some things move independently of other things, and if we, like, clump all of these, like, all of these things into one idea, we're able to much better figure out what's going to happen around us. So, yeah, that was something that I thought was really cool and really interesting.
And what was the name of that research project?
Yeah, the research project was called Hierarchical Abstraction for Combinatorial Generalization. It's a bit of a mouthful. But basically, we then demonstrated this to another level, which is after the idea of objects was discovered, we were then able to use this to then build an AI that could solve problems that involve, like, oh, I want my table to look neat, for instance. These objects are in a mess. I want them to all be, like, organized neatly. So you show it, like, an image of what you want it to look like, and you have this starting state where the objects are all over the place. And it maybe has never seen some of these objects before, and maybe it's never seen so many objects. It might have only ever seen, when you first trained it for it to discover what objects mean, you might have only shown it animations of 3 or 4 objects moving around. And now you suddenly give it a table cluttered with 8 objects, and it has to figure out how to move them around. And so, like, current, like, state-of-the-art AI systems that don't have this idea of independent objects will just be totally flummoxed because they've never seen, the data is so different from the data they've seen before, they won't even know how to interpret it. But this one that discovered the notion of objects is able to, this is what combinatorial generalization is. Like, it's generalizing to these different instances of the problem where, like, combinatorial is sort of saying that there's, like, different combinations. And in this case, actually, like, much more challenging because it's not just different objects in different positions, but different numbers of objects. But it can generalize to this because of it understanding the idea of objects. So, yeah. And the abstraction is the object abstraction.
Wow, that's a lot. So we only have a minute left, so I want to make sure, like, if you were going to recommend for someone who wanted to just have a basic understanding, but a good understanding of artificial intelligence, what resource would you would it be a book? Would it be a website? What can you recommend?
To get, like, a basic beginner level understanding of AI.
And a realistic one at that. As opposed to the ones that, you know, all of the
more hype based.
Yeah, yeah. Like what's really going on.
Yeah, I think I would always recommend trying to read a textbook, actually. Because, yeah, blogs and, like, news websites can sometimes be, like, not, they can have errors in them and mm-hmm. they can be too brief. But I think a textbook is usually, like, really well written and has been gone through so many editions of, like, proofreading and fact-checking that, and it's really designed to, like, lay things out clearly. So I'd say look for, like, a beginner AI textbook. Okay. And there's a bunch out there. But, like, yeah, I guess my advisor actually has written a textbook on AI, but I feel like maybe I should be plugging my advisor. Stuart Russell, there's a textbook called Russell and Norvig, A Modern Approach to Artificial Intelligence. So that might be one thing to check out. But I know there's a number of really good AI textbooks out there. So see what's in the library, see what's on. There's also some like online courses. Like I know there's a famous one from Stanford taught by Andrew Ng. Yeah, I guess it is a bit more of a time investment to read through a textbook. But if you're like, I think it will give you the highest quality of teaching. Yeah.
Well, Lee, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today and for, you know, explaining it to us in a way that we could all understand it. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was fun to talk with you.
And now you can go and enjoy the rest of the Labor Day.
Thanks. You too.
Okay. All right. People of Earth, Artificial Intelligence by someone who is actually intelligent about artificial intelligence. So I'm going to go and enjoy the world now, too. Mr. Ford's going to be here to pleasure your ear hole so that you can enjoy the world just by listening to the radio. I'm going to leave you with Grant Green and Sookie Sookie. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodle-doo.